are remembered and enlivened, and that the hearts on the day of judgment will not die, and the sins will be forgiven, and so on and so forth. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to truly make us understand our relationship with our Lord, and the relationship between Imam Hussein al-Islam and the Lord. Until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This one lay.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. Fishing rights for EU boats in UK waters was a key stumbling block in negotiations for a Brexit trade accord between London and Brussels, which threatened to sink the deal. Well, it has resurfaced again. Britain said that it would grant just 12 out of 47 applications for new licenses for small EU boats, and then 75 applications from French boats to fish in its territorial waters. France has promised retaliation. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the UK is going against this agreement that was made on the Brexit talks. Let's get some details from Amina Taylor, our correspondent who joins us from London. Well, obviously, France is angry. It is promising retaliation, Amina, and tell us more details behind the story.
Well, it seems this is yet another war of words salvo here from the British, and you can justifiably see why the French are upset. There was the promise that vessels that were 12 meters and under and who had a proven record of fishing in inshore British waters would be granted the license, provided everything was above board. And by rejecting 75% of those French applications, the Brits, according to the French, are using this as political gain. Now, we have to recall that not only were these negotiations to try and sort out fishing rights really tense in the lead up to the signing of Brexit, we're even talking back in May here, where boats from the United Kingdom were sent out to Jersey to protect the Jersey coast there. There was a French flotilla to really protest against what they saw as the Brits unnecessarily and unfairly dealing with their ships. So we see things are already tense with France. We had that Australia-US deal just a few weeks ago where ambassadors were recalled. There are still tensions around Brexit. There are those who say perhaps this is a smokescreen in time for the Tory party conference on the weekend to show that we're back to meaning business about Brexit, and it doesn't matter if we offend our one-time closest ally in order to do so. Watch this space, Kaveh.
Okay, Brexit just doesn't end, does it? Okay, very well. Thank you for that, Amina. We appreciate it. Let's bring in Senior Analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, Ian Williams. Also joining us, historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling, who joins us from Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Tony Gosling, I'm going to start with you first here. If you can, give us a quick wrap-up, even though our correspondent kind of did. But tell us exactly what's going on here.
Okay, so look, the background to this is Britain was, I stress, was a great maritime power, particularly during the Second World War, and they absolutely dominated. We dominated this part of the world, and we could fish pretty much where we wanted to, and also could stop others fishing we didn't want to. But that all changed when we joined the European Union. And around about the same time, in fact, we had a Cod War with the Icelandics because we were pushing closer and closer the British fishing vessels to Iceland. And so the Icelandics, quite rightly, well, you know what they did? They extended their fishing range around Iceland, so pushing the British back. And in fact, in 1974, I think it was, there was even a pursuit over 100 nautical miles of a British fishing ship by the Icelandics, who successfully shot at it and captured it because they'd been fishing within the new limits. So this is quite a hot issue in the past. I think this is why the British have now decided that they're only going to award a quarter of the licenses the French have asked for. Now, let's be clear here. It is in the British government's behest to award or not award these licenses. So they will be looking through every application to find any tiny little mistake that the French have made in order to reject that application. So they're dealing with a hostile bureaucracy, basically. And I think it's only fair also to stress that one of the main priorities of the British at the moment is trying to restore stocks of fish, because we've had, under the European Union, a massive depletion of fishing stocks around the British Isles, and one of the main priorities of the British government has been to try and restore those fish stocks. So they're trying. I mean, we haven't got, the British don't have the fishing fleet to fish anything like what we used to do, but they are trying to make sure that all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed and all of these applications before they're granting the rights to these French. So I would suggest that actually these French fishing owners, rather than trying to turn this into a row, should just double check that they've got everything right on these applications, send them in again before they make too much of a fuss, because this is now the British's right to say whether or not they can fish there.
Do you agree with that, Ian Williams?
There is plenty of room for misunderstanding all around. The European fisheries deal was one of the worst aspects of the EU accession for Britain. It destroyed what was left almost of Britain's commercial fishing fleet, and it threw open the so-called British waters. I don't think the fish carry passports, by the way, but it threw open the British waters to competition from lightly regulated, highly subsidized continental fishing fleets. The British government has not really believed in subsidies, certainly not the way the Europeans do. So, I mean, the whole economics of deep sea fishing is very murky at the best of times. There's huge subsidies, huge discounts, because these are very vociferous and noisy political constituencies, no more so than the French. The French fishermen were threatening to blockade the port, threatening to blockade Calais, and there are different attitudes here. The French fishermen and French peasants can get away with things like that. I wouldn't like to try to, if I was an English fisherman or an English farmer, trying to blockade the main road. I think the British police would take a very dull view and wouldn't really notice whether or not you're a politically important constituency or not. They bulldoze right through you and arrest you all. So it's different. There's a clash here. But certainly the point is, the European these waters have been drastically overfished. There's far more fish coming out of them than is sustainable, and it's very difficult to police because in the terms of the UN treaty, these are straddling and highly migratory fish stocks. They move from spawning grounds to other parts, of, you know, from one end of the North Sea to the other. Whose fish are they? But one of the points is, how do you enforce a fishing quota? What you do is you haul the fish out and see what you've got, and then you either throw them back in, which is extremely wasteful. If you've overfished, say, for monkfish or cod, and you've caught too many, you throw them back in. That does nothing for the fish stocks. It does tick off boxes for regulations. Or, what is equally likely, is if you're a typical fisherman who doesn't really believe in this regulation stuff, you'll try to smuggle them out and use them anyway. And then you won't really want to declare your movements when you come to apply for a fishing license on the grounds that you have traditionally been in certain areas. You'll say, what, me in that area? No, no, I never lifted 1,000 tons of illegal cod from that area, ever, ever. It's a very fraught and difficult position, messed up by politics and the economics of fisheries, which are not economic at all. I mean, well, I'm a fond fish eater myself, it's good for your brain, but the economics of where they're lifted from, how they're transported, the fuel that's used, the environmental devastation that takes place with the trawling, it is not something you could put your hand on your heart and say, fish is good for you.
Right. Well, I'm sorry, Tony Gosling, but I need to, I'm a bit confused here. I'm trying to figure out, maybe you could clarify this for us, what the agreement is, what are we looking at when it comes to the fish quantity that Ian Williams talked about there, and whether it's a fair agreement or not, so we can get an idea here and why it is. I mean, you said that the UK is looking for errors that are in the applications, I guess. But overall, what are we looking at in terms of what's right and what's fair? And ultimately, if you can tell us, Tony Gosling, well, there was a deal that was made in the form of Brexit, which included this. So who's in the right and who's in the wrong?
Well, for decades, really, you know, 50 years or so, British, I mean, I've seen it in my lifetime. You know, I'm 58 years old. Our fishing ports have been absolutely decimated around Britain. So, you know, ports where there might have been 20, 30 fishing vessels, that's a small port, have dwindled down sometimes to only one or two fishing vessels or none at all. And that's really because the management of the resources of the seas has been managed from Brussels, no longer from Britain. And so there is, I think, you know, quite a righteous anger, really, in the way that that industry has been decimated. Britain, obviously, is, a traditionally a maritime nation. But I really want to point out that the timing of this is very interesting. You know, this is quite clearly a sort of row relating to Brexit. We've also seen, lack of tanker drivers dispute going on here in Britain over the last week or so, which is also very much related to Brexit and to a certain extent confected, because we know that the oil companies can afford to pay, double wages to delivery drivers if they really want to. These people are not short of cash, as anyone involved in the oil industry will tell you. And then we've also had this international geopolitical dispute with the French over the submarines as well, which has got a kind of nautical flavour too, hasn't it? The British and the Americans agreeing to supply nuclear submarines, nuclear-powered submarines, to the Australians under the noses of the French. So it seems to me that this may be a symptom of a much wider problem, and that is the general idea of Brexit, which is rather strange, isn't it? Because it's a couple of years since Brexit, and yet it's taken a while for these things to work their way through. I'll also point out, though, that we've got something else going on in Britain. This could be to do with the timing of this, and that is it's the party conference season. This week, it's the Labour Party conference, and next week, the Conservative Party conference. And so these are the sorts of issues which will be being played out in those fringe meetings and in the major debates in those conferences. Uh-huh. And the political leaders will be trying to use these disputes in order to assert their readiness to lead the country through these difficult times. So sure. There's a lot going on at the same time here that I think we should be very, I think, pay attention to the timing of this.
Okay, so let's expand more on the timing and also to get your impression on this, Ian Williams. And before I get your reaction to what our guest Tony Gosling there said, France's Maritime Minister, Annick Girardin, let me make sure I'm pronouncing this correctly, Girardin, said French fishing should not be taken hostage by the British for political ends. It sounds like from what Tony Gosling said that maybe that is what may be going on based on the timing. Do you think that's the case?
Well, look, I think it was the worst part of the deal. I think one of the reasons where Boris Johnson showed he was a liar and Nigel Farage, they said that if we had Brexit, then British fisheries would return. They didn't. All the European Union fisheries carried on getting 65% of the quotas of the fish from the waters. I think it's 65%. But there's another aspect where the European fisheries regime might almost be working, and it's coincidence it happened today, but the European courts have ruled that the European Union had no right to sign a fishing treaty with Morocco about Western Saharan fish. So, you know, fish are moving into the center of the of maritime disputes. As you know, Trump declared that he accepted Western Sahara to be part of Morocco, even though the United Nations hasn't, and the courts haven't, and the European courts have ruled that Western Sahara is occupied territory, and that the Moroccans, with their French backers, by the way, their French backers, are not allowed to take the fisheries and to give it and to sell the fish there, except for the benefit of the Western Saharans. And just to add to the hypocrisy, I remember some years ago when this dispute was at the United Nations about the straddling fish stocks, the French were in dispute with Canada because they have two offshore islands, like Jersey and Guernsey, just offshore from Canada, and they were fishing right up to them, the full quota. They were fishing in effectively Canadian waters and overfishing, according to the Canadians. So we had a huge dispute there as well. So there are no halos here. No, there are no wings and no shiny armor. The British government lied to its own people. It lied to Europe. French are quite right there. It's probably being very bureaucratically punctilious about the licenses, but then it's very likely that the French fishermen were lying in their applications by claiming that they're in places that they weren't and denying that they're in places where they were. I mean, there's a lot of anarchy going around here, and you know the regime is pretty much unenforceable, and of course the fish don't get a vote in this. They don't get passports or votes.
Well, again, I'm going to refer to a statement here made, Tony Gosselin, by the French Maritime Minister, where she has said, I count on other European countries to ask for the same thing as France, because what France is going through, they will go through the same thing, the same bad will from Britain, which will not be expressed only on this issue. Do you think that the UK will take up other issues that will be out of the agreement of Brexit, perhaps?
Well, look, I don't think that's the case at all. I think what's happening is Brussels and Paris are picking a fight here with the Brits. I mean, you know, they can apply for these licenses again. You'll probably find that most of those that were turned down will be accepted if they're written down honestly and that these people are actually entitled to fish now. But, you know, this is something which I think it only benefits Brussels by doing this, because What they tend to do is they want to send a message, don't they, to all those other countries that are getting sick and tired of the European Union. And I'm talking here, actually, there's many in France, including the Yellow Vests, who were so cleverly gotten out of the way by all these COVID measures in France, the very strict curfews and things like that. They wanted out of the European Union. They see it as a rich man's club. The same is true in Greece, in many other countries in the EU. In fact, there's many in Germany that want out of the whole Brussels arrangement as well. So these various countries are looking at Britain. How are they getting on? And it actually looks like Britain's been doing reasonably well, doesn't it? Not too many problems over here so far. And so I think we're going into a sort of silly season here where the European Union and the French particularly at the moment are doing everything they can to stir things up and also to try and make it look as if the UK... And they actually have quite a lot of allies within Britain, these big mega corporations, transnational corporations, who are also pro-EU, some of which are based in London, And they are doing whatever they can to stir things up. And this is just simply another example. And it's getting really nasty, I see, today in Jersey. They believe in this little channel island just off the coast of France, which is owned by the Brits, that they're actually considering now that they may have a blockade of their port, because so many of these licenses of the ships based in, the French ships based in Jersey, have been turned down. So they just have to accept this, I think. And it's part of the Brexit deal. If they want to fish, they need a license. And I'm afraid that's just part of the deal. They have to suck it up, I'm afraid.
In Williams, is that going to happen? Do you think the French fishermen especially will do that?
Well, look, as I said, the French peasantry and the fishermen have a sort of a collective attitude, which is almost proletarian. They believe in collective action. They will dump tomatoes and potatoes on the road to ports. They'll dump rotten fish in places. They will collectively blockade ports. Now, they're allowed to do that because they're a politically important constituency. In Britain, they're not. You know, if they blockaded the port of Dover, then I'm sure a Navy frigate would just go right through the middle of them after due warning. And, you know, they've had it. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But the whole... I did not agree with Britain going into the European Union, but when it did, and recently, I didn't agree with it coming out. I think that Brexit has been a complete disaster all along, and it provides over and over expedient reasons for the government to lie and cheat. Boris Johnson's government lied about Northern Ireland, and then it broke the agreement. And the sad thing is that for all of its many faults, perfidious Albion, the UK, for many years was actually outstanding for its application of European law, even when it was inconvenient to itself. Unlike some other countries, particularly in the Mediterranean, where the attitude was you took whatever money came from the UN and you refused to accept their responsibilities. If you look at Hungary now, for example, where they want all the UN's, the European Union subsidies, but refuse to accept any of the regulations and the stipulations about free courts that go with it. Britain has been better than that, but in the last few years, it hasn't been. It's sunk into they're wallowing in the mud with everybody else. Mm-hmm. So there's no telling. There'll be lots of mud to be thrown from both sides.
Okay.
And neither of them are going to be angelic with halos or wings about it. They're all going to be covered in mud, and sure, they deserve it. They've all been involved in sordid politics.
Okay. Well, Tony Gosselin, you got this, you got the thing with AUKUS in terms of what happened. Obviously, lots of tensions there that have been created. But my question to you is how badly is this relationship at this point negatively affected? And is this just a temporary thing, or how do you see it? How do you project this to go?
Well, okay, so I think our relationship with the French has always been pretty up and down. Although we're very close by, with a very, you know, different language, a different culture. In many ways, the French have got a fantastic culture, haven't they? The food and all that. And I think, we love visiting France. But in terms of the European Union, which the French really, really represent, they are the EU's in the front line for the EU against Britain. And they're seen, Macron particularly, is seen as the sort of person that has got to teach the Brits a lesson. And I think there's a lot of that almost infantile stuff going on here. The deals have all been signed, and to a certain extent, the British have got some very difficult... we've been used to being dependent on European trade for many, many years, and that's got quite easy for some people. Very, very easy, in fact, to get all sorts of goods across the channel but without very much paperwork. And now, actually, what's happened is, over the last couple of years, all the British industries have done, I think, very well in sourcing stuff much more locally, in going through the paperwork and importing stuff when they need to, but actually being more self-sufficient. And I think that's actually quite important in the modern world, particularly with all the geopolitical tensions, that the British are independent here.
I think
we've done a fairly good job in making sure that we're establishing control over some resources that we ceded.
I got to jump in, Tony Gosselin. Sorry, give Ian Williams 30 seconds before we end this. Ian Williams, I saw you shaking your head. Go ahead.
I think the British government have made a disastrous job. They weren't prepared. They didn't seem to realize that Dover was the ports of Dover and Calais were the main route for most goods. They haven't managed to substitute stuff. They have managed to destroy British industry single-handed since the days of Margaret Thatcher. And I come from an industrial area. I watched it happen. I can show you the factories where they used to be. They destroyed British industry. Part of that process was joining the European Union. Since then, they've managed to destroy it all over again, because what industry there was left was dependent on an intricate network across Europe, which they're now disrupting for infantile political flag-waving reasons.
Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Thank you very much for that. Let me thank Amina Taylor, a correspondent, spoke to us at the top of the hour, senior analyst of Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, speaking there from New York. And thank you, Tony Gosselin, historian and investigative journalist from Bristol. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwani and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
You see, when Allama Jaafari has a good communication and writing different letters and receiving responses from Bertrand Russell, who is known as a philosopher in the West, it shows that he was really understanding the language they would talk in.
He mentioned in his lecture, philosophy is to answer four questions. Number one, the interaction of human being with himself. Number two, the interaction of human being with God. Number three, the interaction of human being with the universe. Number four, interaction of human being with the other individuals of his society.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. The Teacher is mainly concerned with the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim dignitaries, especially the Shiite ones. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaini. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to your show.
Alaikum assalamu rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaini, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalamu rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Today, and in upcoming sessions of the program, The Teacher, we want to talk about an outstanding figure in the world of Shia Islam. He is no one but the late Allama Muhammad Taqi Jaafari. He is included among the best contemporary philosophers, or especially say Muslim philosophers. Of course, this philosophy is very much different from the philosophy in the Western tone, but what is known is that his most outstanding works were written in this field of study. We will dedicate this session and the upcoming one to the life of Allama Jaafari. Let's start with you, Sheikh Mahdavi. What information do we have about his early background, his early life?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. If we wanted to have a quick look at his lifetime, we can categorize his lifetime in different session. He is born to one of the villages of Tabriz in 1304, which is beginning of 20s in according to the Gregorian calendar.
That's right.
So he stayed there, he raised there for 15 years, he's been there, and he learned the Quran with his mother, and he was forced to work because of the poverty of the family at that time. Okay. Then when he was 15, he moved to Tehran. He joined the madrasa of Filsuf. Filsuf is the name of that school.
Oh.
That was a good coincidence because he ended up being a good philosopher.
Okay.
So when he was 15, he joined that school. After that, he joined the seminary school, Marvi, Madrasa Marvi, which is known for Marvi.
Yes, famous.
And and after 3 years, he moved to Qom for 1 year almost. He stayed in Qom. It is narrated that he started to wear this turban and clergy wearing specific wearing in Qom. And then from Qom, he moved to Najaf. He stayed in Najaf for almost 11 years, during which he benefited from different ulama, fuqaha, usuliyin, Namely, we can say he got the permission of ijtihad from Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Milani.
Sayyid Muhammad Hadi Milani, yes. Mashhad, that's right.
Yes, okay. In that time. And okay. Then from Najaf, he went back to Iran, 1 year stayed in Mashhad, and after all, he came back to Tehran until the end of his life. Right. He stayed in Tehran.
That's all right.
This is a timeline on the biography of Allama Muhammad Taqi Jafari.
Very good. The interesting part about the wearing the clerical robe or this imama, you know, if some of our listeners are not interested, this somehow is a ceremony that people who is in the earlier stages of studying in the seminary goes to a high caliber alim, and that by his hand put the turban on the head, and then officially he's now a student of Islamic studies. And this ceremony is still followed by so many scholars and so many ulama in the city of Qom, Mashhad and Najaf. A really beautiful one when the tulab or the students of the seminaries are very much young, try to wear this we can say labas or robe, you know, clerical robe. This is very beautiful. Okay, thank you, Sheikh Mahtavi. Sheikh Ziyanel, let's get to you, brother. So what made Allama Jafari interested in philosophy? I mean, the Filsuf Madras, how we say it, might be one reason, okay, but the name coincides with the field of study in which he was interested. And, you know, when I was just taking a look at his life account, you know, I found him very much in connection with the most outstanding philosophers and thinkers out of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the Western philosophy too. We'll get to that. But what made him interested in this field, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. About the interest and work of Allama Ja'fari in philosophy, we may say that from his youth he was interested in philosophy because we may say that he was interested in modern issues. Unlike many other students of Islamic seminary in Najaf, he was interested in issues that were presented or were current on those times.
That's right.
So even he had some, you know, interactions and relationships with marhum Muhammad Ridha Muzaffar, Allama Muzaffar rahmatullah alayh, who was a person and a figure who tried to make new changes in the Islamic seminary of Najaf.
Especially the books with compiling.
Yes.
The new format and the new methods in compiling the books of the House of Qom. Very good.
Even Allama Ja'fari had some, you know, discussions with Ahmad Amin, a mathematic scholar in Iraq.
That's right.
And that's why he compiled and wrote his book, The Interaction Between Human Being and the Universe.
Oh.
When he was only 28 or 30 years old.
Okay, very great.
So from that time, he was interested in philosophy, and he decided to continue studying in this field.
That's right.
And when we go to his manner of studying, we find out that Allama Ja'fari, for example, once he went to Greece, and it was a seminary there.
That's right.
He was invited by the university there. And when he participated in the gathering, he mentioned in his lecture in the Congress that philosophy is to answer four questions, either of these four questions.
Okay.
Number one, the interaction of human being with himself.
Very good.
Number two, the interaction of human being with God.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, the interaction of human being with the universe. Number four, then interaction of human being with the other individuals of his society.
Okay.
So we see that in his young age, he is trying to answer one of these four questions.
That's all right.
And that's it, the interaction between the human being and the universe.
That's all right.
So it shows us that he was following an stream here.
Yes.
And he had a plan for his life.
That's right.
That's why everybody knows him as an Allama, a person who has knowledge in different fields.
Yeah, polymath. And this is really strange for a cleric in the Islamic House of Qom and Najaf. to follow such fields of study. But this has been a very, I think, beautiful fashion among some of the students of the Islamic Hawza not to limit themselves only to fiqh and usul or the Holy Quran and the Hadith, and try to play the bigger role, I mean, in terms of the universal scene. And this is what made Allama Ja'fari and other students of philosophy interested in having interactions with the outstanding figures in the world. And who were they, Sheikh Mahtavi? I mean, the people who had interaction with, can you name some of them for us? And based on what methodology he wanted to answer these four questions, I mean, the interaction with himself, God, universe, and the individuals around.
Actually, he has a Islamic methodology, yes, even in the philosophy. As our brother mentioned, when we are talking about the philosophy, we don't mean the Western philosophy, yes, but for someone to speak with those who are graduated from the Western schools and universities and they master the philosophy which is taught in their universities, they have to master their language, otherwise they can't have kind of communication. That's why we see when Allama Ja'fari has a good communication and writing different letters and receiving responses from Bertrand Russell, who is known as a philosopher in the West, it shows that he was really understanding the language they would talk,
that's right,
in.
Okay.
So it shows us it was not only taking the classes, I mean the traditional classes in philosophy, and having no knowledge about the common language of the world when, okay, they are speaking of the philosophy.
Yes.
Among which we have another philosophers from Germany. I have to mention some points that is going to take us out of the issue of philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at the people to which he has contact and communication, we see the names of poets.
Okay.
We see the names, yes, of someone like George Jordaak.
Yes.
He has a memorial photo with George Jordaak.
Yes.
And this is because of the this title that we are giving to this person. When we say Allama, Allama, yes, is not a cheap title,
yes,
to be given, mm-hmm, to a person easily.
Yes.
That's why we see when it comes to literature of Arabic, when it comes to Hadith, we see he has conducted a commentary consisting of 27 volumes on Nahj al-Balagha.
Yes.
So it takes him to the position that he can communicate with somebody like George Jordaak.
That's all right.
And in another field, when it comes to Persian literature, we, yes, see he's the one actually to have or to conduct commentary on Masnavi Ma'navi.
Yes.
Is not something that you only have to master Farsi or Persian,
yes,
literature. You have to know mysticism. You have to know philosophy. Most of the people who master Masnavi Ma'navi, they know how difficult it is to read one line from the poems of Maulana.
Maulana, that's right. And this makes it very important, especially Maulana, mainly known as Rumi,
yeah,
in the Western world, you know, and his works are really great. And just look at how the commentaries or interpretations of someone like Allama Ja'fari, who himself has mastery over Islamic studies and philosophy and hikmah and mysticism, can help us to know Maulana more, yeah, than the Western interpretations, which I think have a wrong commentary and interpretation out of Maulana. This is really beautiful. As you said, the literature, in the artistic form, I mean, he was concerned with the field aesthetics, you know, the knowledge of the beauty or knowing how beautiful the things are, and the music that the books that he compiled in this field. All in all, when we take a look at the works that were produced by Allama Ja'fari, we can find the variety of the fields of study in which he had mastery. That's why, as you said, it's made him Allama. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi. Sheikh Ziyaynia, which field of study do you think he's best in?
Let me answer to this question by a quotation from Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh.
Mm-hmm.
Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, when he wants to talk about Allama Ja'fari, he explains as this. He says, آقای جعفری ابن سینای زمان ما هستند.
Oh.
He says that Allama Ja'fari is
the Ibn Sina of the time.
The Avicenna of the time.
The Avicenna, yes.
That's right.
So it shows that, the philosophy side of his life is,
highlighted.
Highlighted and has a shadow over other approaches of his knowledge.
That's right.
But of course, he was a teacher in fiqh and usul. He taught fiqh and usul in Najaf, Makasib, and also Rasail and Kifayah. He taught them in Najaf. And also when he came back to Qom, he was a prominent teacher regarding different, issues. Even late Allama Mutahhari says about him that we give words to people, but Allama Ja'fari is giving spirituality to people.
Very good.
And this side is a very important side of his life.
That's right.
That Allama Ja'fari was, first of all, he was very humble. He was in close connection with people.
That's right.
And he had many different students from different, groups of people.
Yes.
For example, he had students in University of Tehran.
Yes.
He had students in the Islamic Seminary of Qom and even some other, students that they were not participating, frequently in his classes, but they were coming here for some courses and to have some, discussions with him.
Yes.
So, beside being a prominent alim and scholar, he was very humble and showing courtesy to people.
That's right.
For example, let me give you this story that once one of his neighbors, she was a Jewish woman.
That's right.
She says that we had a problem, a judiciary problem, and we were not able to fix the problem ourselves. We were not, having good knowledge about the system.
Yes.
So we were looking for a person to help us.
Okay.
And we went to the door of late Allama Ja'fari, and he accepted us with open arms, and he helped us in the judiciary problem, and we were able to fix and, solve the problem that we were facing with but his help. So even non-Muslims had good connection with him.
Thank you very much. It was very kind of you, Sheikh Zainian, Sheikh Mahdavi. That's all we have time for today's discussion. We will continue our discussion with the life and works of the late Allama Muhammad Taghi Ja'fari in our upcoming session of the program. Thank you very much for this episode.
You're welcome.
You're most welcome.
Dear audience, thank you very much too for listening to us. This is the teacher, I'm Atta, the host of this program. For more information on this episode and the other episodes of this program, visit our website at parstudio.com/EnColorOfIslam page. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Some major international humanitarian agencies are warning about the consequences of the economic crisis in Afghanistan due to widespread joblessness, poverty, and U.S. sanctions on the country. Either war or unemployment has forced Hamid and hundreds of other families to flee their homes and get to Kabul in search of a better life. But contrary to their expectations, they are living here in this camp in northern Kabul for the internally displaced. They are living dire conditions and deprived of basic services.
We left our village in Baghlan province after the escalation of clashes back in July. Now we are living here while we have no access to our basic needs, such as portable water, electricity, or healthcare services. Hundreds of people here are suffering from malnutrition as well.
Abdullah is another internally displaced man who also lives here with his family members. He says nor the Taliban, neither humanitarian aid agencies have so far met their needs. Therefore, he asks for implementation of a transparent supporting plan for people like himself and the rest of vulnerable Afghans who are suffering from hunger and malnutrition.
Humanitarian aid should be distributed among the neediest families like us. But so far, we have seen that most of those who are in charge of handing out humanitarian assistance are corrupt figures because they usually distribute the aid among their own relatives and friends.
Under such circumstances, the Taliban administration has also called on the international community and humanitarian aid agencies to resume their aid supplies to Afghanistan. This comes as some neighboring countries of Afghanistan, like Iran and Pakistan, have begun sending humanitarian aid to Kabul, a move that is widely welcomed by both the Taliban and ordinary Afghans, especially the internally displaced ones.
A rise in the number of internally displaced people has put pressure on Afghanistan. Moreover, Afghans are already denied access to their assets, as Washington has frozen them under the name of slapping sanctions on the Taliban. However, facts on the ground show that Washington's move has affected the lives of ordinary Afghans, especially internally displaced people, rather than affecting the Taliban. Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Russia has warned NATO against setting up military infrastructure in Ukraine. It comes after Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said the United States is creating military bases in Ukraine under the guise of establishing training centers. Lukashenko said he has discussed the issue with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, and they agreed to take action to counter the growing NATO activity.
It's actions that will provide for the strategic interests and security of our two allied states. The issue of potential expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine was numerously mentioned by President Putin, and President Putin said it was beyond a red line he had talked about repeatedly.
Moscow has time and again warned against NATO's expansion in Ukraine, saying it is a red line the West will regret crossing. Last week, Russia held large-scale joint military drills with Belarus. The maneuvers followed Ukraine's joint war games with the U.S. and other NATO member states. Tensions have been simmering between Moscow and Kiev since the ouster of Ukraine's elected president Viktor Yanukovych in a U.S.-backed revolt in 2014. The tensions further escalated after Crimea declared autonomy from Ukraine to reunite with the Russian Federation. The so-called revolution in Ukraine and Kiev's subsequent reach out to NATO could be part of a puzzle being pieced together by the United States and its allies to contain Russia militarily.
Yemeni
Israelis have condemned what the Iraqi government has described as an illegal meeting held in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. The meeting demanded Baghdad join the so-called Abraham Accords and normalize ties with Israel.
We believe in the rights of the Palestinian people to liberate their land, and therefore we will stand against any attempt to normalize relations with Israel. The recent illegal meeting in the Iraqi city of Erbil is completely rejected. It's a desperate attempt after the failure of the so-called deal of the century. Palestine will be liberated and Israelis will be expelled.
Yemen's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour slammed the meeting, saying it is an attempt to drag the free people of Iraq to normalize relations with the Israeli regime, adding those who have normalized ties with Israel are part of the Zionist project in the region.
The normalization meeting that was held in Erbil, Iraq, is an attempt to drag the Iraqi people into normalization with the Israeli enemy and for Iraq to become part of the Zionist project, as some Arab rulers did last year. But the conference failed and was rejected by all the free and resistance forces in Iraq because it is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause and the Islamic nation.
The so-called Abraham Accords is a U.S.-led Middle East initiative aimed at establishing diplomatic relations and full normalization between Arab countries and the Israeli regime. This agreement was signed by Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, and Sudan, and was welcomed by Israeli officials.
Yemenis have praised the Iraqi government's rejection of normalization of ties with Israel. They say the free people of the world will always support the Palestinian cause until the liberation of the occupied territories. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Prominent cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki is the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria known as the IMN. The top Muslim cleric and his supporters have been subject to a crackdown by Nigerian authorities over the past years. The most brutal attack took place in December 2015 in the northern city of Zaria, Kaduna State. The army opened fire on Zakzaki's supporters, killing hundreds, including three of his sons. The military accused the sheikh's supporters of having tried to stop the passing convoy of the army chief to assassinate him. The IMN vehemently denied that accusation. During the crackdown, Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife suffered gunfire wounds. They were taken into custody under the pretext of protecting them from violence in Zaria. But they were later charged with culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, and disruption of public peace, among other things. A year later, the Abuja High Court ordered their release, but the Nigerian government defied the order. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife remained in prison until July 28th this year, when they were released after a Kaduna High Court dismissed all charges against them. The IMN welcomed the ruling, saying it is a victory of perseverance in the face of extreme persecution. Kaduna state officials later acknowledged in a report that the military had acted disproportionately in connection with Sheikh Zakzaki and the Zaria massacre, and that the soldiers involved should be punished. No one has so far been prosecuted over the incident.
British government considering sending in army personnel in an effort to alleviate the fuel crisis that has seen back-to-back queues or empty forecourts across the UK over the past days. Drivers across the capital especially have been involved in a desperate game of trying to beat their neighbour to a petrol station that was still lucky enough to have some fuel left.
I basically just ran out of fuel, and but I've been trying several of them, and then everyone just been shutting down. So it's quite bad, really, you know. I mean, I never thought, you know, I mean, we're going to run out of fuel. I thought maybe one day we're going to run out of food, but not of fuel.
This morning, we are supposed to have a delivery. Because due to shortage of drivers, we couldn't get a delivery. It has been postponed till tonight now. To be honest with you, since the Brexit, this thing has happened, like, you know. A lot of drivers have gone back home, like, and hence, there is a shortage in the haulage industry.
It's empty forecourts like these that will no doubt be causing political anxiety for the government. But none will be more stressed than the British consumer, who might be wondering where might they get the next full tank in order to make it to school, to make it to work, to make it through the day.
The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, is keen to describe this not as a crisis exacerbated by Brexit, but one manufactured by the haulier industry, who says they need over 100,000 extra drivers to meet current need. There's also been a degree of blame placed at the feet of the consumers for panic buying and driving up demand unnecessarily.
There's no shortage of the fuel within the country. So the most important thing is actually that if people carry on as they normally would and fill up their cars when they normally would, then you won't have queues and you won't have shortages at the pump either.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has already announced a three-month visa scheme to tempt experienced EU HGV drivers back to the UK to assist until Christmas, and the role the army could play is also being explored.
We are bringing MOD trainers in to accelerate some of the HGV training. We've to clear a backlog of people who want to carry out those tests, so there's definitely a role there for the MOD.
In the meantime, consumers want to guarantee that they are not left stranded, and if that means driving miles in search of the precious fuel, it's a journey they're willing to make. Amina Taylor, London.
A latest study by the National Farmers Association Coldiretti has found that difficulties in trade with the UK could put €3.6 billion worth of Made in Italy agri-food exports at risk. Italy's agri-food exports into the UK have already decreased by over 2% since Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed a Brexit trade deal with the EU back in December. Experts say the drop is a direct consequence of Brexit.
From January 1st, Brexit has introduced more bureaucracy, more tax, and a completely new and complex regulatory environment, which have greatly affected the trade volume between the UK and the EU. It must be said that our agri-food products have suffered a drop in trading revenue in Britain only.
The UK ranks fourth among Italy's food and beverage trading partners after Germany, France and the US. Pasta, tomato derivatives, cheese and dairy products are the main Italian export items to the UK.
Among other Italian products exported to Britain are transport, clothing, machinery and appliances and metals. Trade volume between the two countries stood at about €35 billion in 2020, but due to red tape and no tariffs, many are concerned it might drop significantly in the coming months.
We knew full well that Brexit would have had serious consequences. Having said that, Italy's production system is strong. Our high-quality agri-food products are in great demand.
Coldiretti has also expressed concern over the decision by Downing Street to move away from European food standards. This way, Britain risks being flooded with cheaply produced or counterfeit food and drinks. Max Civili, Rome.
As Afghans witness their most difficult days amid the collapse of government and newly settlement of Taliban's emirate, Islamic Republic of Iran delivers its third round of medical and food aids to Afghanistan. This Iranian plane carrying humanitarian aid arrived at Kabul airport on Saturday, containing several tons of rice and other basic food products.
The plane that you see here has brought Iranian aids containing 15 tons of food products. We are here to sort out the aid supplies. We thank neighboring countries that help us in this critical situation and stand by our side after the withdrawal of the U.S. forces.
Due to buzzer shortage and increasing prices of food and medical goods, Afghans in major cities and villages demand humanitarian aids. Furthermore, they're concerned about their assets being frozen by the U.S.
We are in a critical situation. Public assets, including our salaries, have been blocked, and most of us have lost our jobs.